Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. All right, temperatures in the high 70s today and tomorrow have got to be motivation to get out and play in the dirt again, gardeners. This is an ideal opportunity to get filthy while you prep your lawn, garden, and surroundings so next spring and summer are aesthetically and nutritionally bountiful. Whether it's planting bulbs, trees, or shrubs, composting, fertilizing, cutting back plants, or knowing what to do about storing your squash and vegetables, we're going to have answers for you today. Gardening expert and Vermont Garden Journal host Charlie Nardozzi joins us for the whole hour today. Charlie, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
It's good to be here, Rick.
Excellent. All right. So let's see. What kinds of things can we start planning now for next spring?
Well, it is mid-October, or close enough.
Yeah.
So this is the time of year that we want to start planting those spring flowering bulbs, the tulips, daffodils, crocus, hyacinths, scillas, grape hyacinths, all those bulbs that you see blooming in April, May, and June around here. This is the time of year you want to do that. You also want to be planting your garlic and shallots, too. You want to plant those in the fall so that you can get them next summer. And if the weather continues to stay as balmy as it is today, yeah, and Wednesday, which it won't, but it's generally staying pretty warm this fall, you can still be planting trees and shrubs, especially deciduous ones. So there's a number of things you could be doing in your yard that will set you up for next year and get things ready for the winter as well.
Well, let's talk about those bulbs. Why are these bulbs able to survive the winter? And why is it good to plant them now rather than wait until next year?
Well, they need a dormant period. And so that's the whole idea with a lot of these, the tulips, daffodils, hyacinths, all those bulbs. So they need a cool period so they can go into dormancy, kind of get their roots established, get settled. And then when it warms up next spring, that's when they start growing. So in reality, you could have warm weather like in February if we were further south, and they would actually start growing and blooming. So they only need a couple months of dormancy and winter chill in order to start growing. But because we're in Vermont and we have colder winters and longer winters, that's why they don't actually start growing until April or May.
I think I could use a period of dormancy for a couple months. Well, then how do we protect them from varmints, those critters that might find them particularly tasty in the dead of winter?
Yes, that's one of the big questions, right? So you get voles. Moles don't really go after the bulbs, but the voles and the mice and chipmunks and squirrels, they will dig around, especially if you planted them in the fall and the soil is nice and loose. And even more especially if you put down some fertilizer down there too, because now they've got a scent of something down there that's interesting. So there's a couple things you can do. If you've had trouble in the past with these little four-legged critters digging up your bulbs or eating them through the winter, you can plant ones that they don't really like daffodils, for example, or fritillarias, or some of the scillas and grape hyacinths. They're not going to really bother with those. They really like tulips. They're kind of high-end animals. They like the tulips, and they'll eat those. You can plant some of those bulbs they tend not to like. They may dig them up just because they're curious what's going on there, but they tend not to eat them, and that's the biggest question. The other thing you can do is you can put something sharp down around the bulbs when you plant them. Now, there are a lot of home recipes, kind of home remedy ideas that have been floated around for years, like crushed eggshells, for example, and sharp sand. Those don't really work very well. Mm. The thing you want is something really sharp. So you want crushed oyster shells. It's like a grit almost kind of thing, or even some crushed granite rock, something that's got a real kind of sharp edge and kind of a dusty, gritty texture to it. You plant those bulbs around that or in the middle of all of that. So when the tunneling happens, they come down. They're not going to like that grit and that powder kind of on their paws and in their respiratory systems. Oh, and that'll kind of keep them away.
Wow. And then is now the time when we should divide and spread perennial plants? And how's that done?
Well, the rule of thumb of perennials is if it blooms in the spring, you divide it in late summer, fall. If it blooms late summer, fall, you divide it in the spring. And then if it's a hosta or a daylily, you divide it whenever you want because you can't kill those plants. So this time of year, it's getting a little late to start dividing things like peonies. September would have been a better month. But if you're in the Champlain Valley, the Southern Connecticut River Valley, you know, places that will stay say, a little bit warmer a little bit later in the fall, you probably still could dig them up, divide them, transplant them, and make sure you keep them well watered, right, even into November. Wow. Because the root system will continue to grow as long as the temperatures are above 40 degrees. So you want to keep them well watered and protected, maybe put some mulch around them. So things like peonies you can divide now. You can try to divide some of the bearded irises now, even though, again, it's a little bit on the late side for that. Anything that's kind of that early season crops, Siberian irises, you could divide now. And the things you want to wait in the spring would be more of what's blooming now. So everything from the black-eyed Susans, the Rudbeckias, the sedums, the asters, the monk's hood, aconitum, any of those fall blooming plants, wait till the spring to divide those.
All right. I'll hold back on those. We got a couple questions from Dick in North River, New York, one on garlic, one on broccoli. So let's stay with garlic for now. He says, I'm still trying to mitigate white rot in garlic. Lately, I've been using the garlic powder in a bed to be used the following year, tricking the mold to germinate, then finding no substrate, they die. But we also want to try mycorrhizal inoculant. What can you tell me about possible effectiveness?
So if you have white mold, I guess the first thing I'm thinking of is that if you could move the bed or plant your garlic in another bed, rotate the crop around, that's going to help because the white mold may not be as prevalent in some of your other beds. And of course, even though a lot of us will use the same bulbs that we harvested this summer and then replant some of those in the fall, which is a nice thing to do, it might be worth, in this case, for him to go out and buy some disease-resistant bulbs from a garden center, somewhere where you know that they've been tested, they're totally disease resistant, so you're not continuing to spread that same disease throughout your garden. If you do want to try some of those bioactivated type of fungicides that are out there, these are biofungicides that are like a bacteria or another fungus that fights the fungus in the soil.
And that's what this inoculant
and that's what he's talking
be.
About. Yeah. Actinivate is one of those, for example, that you can spread around the soil. You can try that, but I think some of these other cultural things would probably be more beneficial, and you'll see better results if you can rotate it around and get fresh garlic bulbs in the soil.
I thought you were going to beneficial nematodes there for a second.
Ah, not yet.
No. Okay. And then his second question was, I lost all my broccoli this spring to woodchucks, but that's another story. So I planted again for fall broccoli with small starts in July. They're quite big now, but alas, no heads forming. Is there a trick I should be doing? They're in a hoop house with a row cover.
Well, I think they will eventually get to that point of actually forming heads. I think what they could do is, because it's broccoli and it's frost tolerant, you probably could either open up the hoop house, you know, the sides of it. I'm not sure the structure and how it looks, but the doors on the ends or the sides of it, however, you can get more airflow through there and more cold air in there. So they can stimulate it to perhaps think about sending up a head and getting something you can eat out of it. What might be happening, especially if he's done some nice fertilizing in there with compost and he's got a rich soil, is that you're getting a big broccoli plant, but it's a lot of leaf growth because there's a lot of nitrogen fertilizer that's there. And so it's taking its time to form the actual flower. So stressing it a little bit, you know, don't fertilize it this time of year. Maybe don't water it as much. Open it up, especially on chilly nights, so you get some cold air flowing in there, and that might stimulate it to form some heads.
That's excellent. All right, let's talk to Bob. He's calling us from Mount Tabor. Bob, what's your question for Charlie today?
My question is, when is the correct time to cut back asparagus fronds?
Well, you could do it pretty much any time starting now, but I like to leave them till they yellow because they're actually kind of attractive, having a nice fall foliage look to them. But you want to do it before the winter really sets in. So I'd say anytime now till December. You cut them right back to the ground and then remove them from the area.
All right, let's talk about soil, Charlie, because I know this is a great time to be kind of building for next year.
Right.
So what kinds of things should people be doing to better their soil's health over the winter?
Well, one of the first things I always recommend, especially in the fall, is to do a soil test, and especially if you haven't done it for 3 or 4 years, and whether it be a flower garden, vegetable garden, orchard, whatever it is, lawn even. And you can get these test kits at garden centers and home stores, but I like to use University of Vermont. They have the Extension Service has a soil lab up there, and for a nominal fee, I think it's only still $20, something close to that, $15, $20. You can get a basic analysis of what your pH is, what your nutrient levels are for your main nutrients, what your organic matter content is, and some other more scientific things like the cation exchange capacity. We won't go there.
All right, good.
But the whole point is
my head just exploded there.
I saw those cations flying out of your ears. The whole idea is that you're going to get a snapshot view of what's going on in your garden, what the pH is in your organic matter, if there are any major nutrients that are out of whack. And if you do it every 3 or 4 years, then you can compare. How am I doing as far as adding compost and organic matter, nutrients when they're needed, where's my pH, all of those things. So fall is a nice time to do it because you get a real accurate reading. The soils are still warm. You've had crops there all summer, so they've kind of depleted whatever was in that soil. So you get a nice reading of what it's going to look like for next year. And the labs are not that busy.
Well, what happens when the pH of the soil is too acid or too base or alkaline? I mean, do we want the soil to always be at 7, the neutral?
Yeah, so seven is neutral. And depending upon what you're growing, you want it a little bit above, a little bit below. So we'll take vegetables, for example. Most vegetables grow well between 6.5 and 7.2. So a little on the acidic side up to neutral. There are, you know, and that's probably a general rule for most flowers, most trees, most plants in general. But then there are special plants like rhododendrons and blueberries that like an acidic soil. So they want pHs below 6, sometimes even below 5. So knowing what you're growing will dictate what kind of amendments you want to put on the soil, whether it be more sulfur to make it acidic or more lime to make it a little more alkaline. And then also based on the soil test, if you have an acidic soil and you need to bring the pH up closer to neutral, you have a choice of a calcitic lime or a dolomitic lime. And the difference is, I'm glad you asked, Rick.
Yes. You can see the big question mark over here.
Calcitic, dolomitic? Dolomites, aren't they in Italy? Yes, they are. Dolomitic lime has magnesium in it. So if your soil is deficient in magnesium, that's a nice way to actually add a little magnesium as you're raising up the pH.
As you're trying to get this right, does it matter if your soil is clay-based or sand-based or anything?
Well, that's another reason for doing the soil test. Based on the kind of soil you have, they'll give you recommendations and how much lime to bring up the pH to the recommended area depending on what you're growing. So yes, it does make a difference. Sand generally will not hold nutrients or the cation exchange capacity as well as clay will.
Now, is this the time of year that we start to use that compost from the pile we've been adding to all year?
Well, hopefully it's if it's rotted down well, if it was early in the season and now you're getting to it, you know, 5-6 months later, yeah, that would be a nice thing you can add to your garden. And of course, now is a good time to be making compost. You've got a lot of organic matter. You're cutting back perennials, you're pulling out annuals, you're taking out the vegetables. You've got a lot of leaves that are blowing around, so you can start making compost piles. And we could go into all the details of making them, but generally, if you want to make just a passive pile, just pile it all together. Just throw it all together, put it in some kind of bin, usually a 2 or 3 bin system, so that by next spring or early summer, you can move it into the next bin and leave that first bin open. If you want to be more active, then you have to think about layering and having the right ratio of carbon materials to nitrogen materials and the right moisture levels too.
And are there things we should be doing during the winter for that compost pile?
Well, once it freezes up, no.
Okay.
There really isn't anything.
I can relax.
You can relax. Get it set up, get it going, and then let nature take its course.
And then we do have the state's food scrap composting laws changing in 2020.
Right.
So are there things people should start preparing for now?
So that's always a great thing to do is that food scraps by 2020, if you're not familiar with the law, are going to be phased out as something that you can just throw in the trash. So it's either going to be your trash hauler will take them away, or you can bring them to a drop-off place, or you can compost them yourself. And it's really not as hard as most people think. You know, especially if you get some of these black boxes like the Soil Saver box, or if you get more active, you can get the tumblers, a little more active composting going on. And the key with that is that you're putting food scraps into that compost bin, but you just don't throw them in there and then shut the lid. You should have a pile close to the composter with dried leaves, maybe chopped up some leaves, some hay or straw. Just have that pile there. And so every time you add a pile of food scraps in, you want to add a handful of that material. That will balance it out, balance out the moisture levels, balance out the nitrogen levels, and that way you won't get flies, you won't get as many animals interested in going in there, and the compost will be a better compost when it's finished.
Okay, so you talked about the UVM Gardening Department and soil testing. So Chandra emailed, I had my soil tested at the beginning of the spring by the UVM Gardening Department. It tested very high in nitrogen. I had been using Mudu, composted cow manure, and ProGrow fertilizer. I grew tomatoes in the plot, and they did fine. What would you advise I do next?
Probably nothing. That's a good answer. If you had high nitrogen in the spring,
yeah.
This is, of course, before all the plants have been growing and using up that nitrogen. And nitrogen is a nutrient that is very volatile, meaning it doesn't stay in the soil very long, and it gets used up or gets washed away really easily. So I would guess that if she had that soil test done now, it would probably be at a normal level or maybe even a little bit low. So if the plants performed well, you can always just look at your plants. If you get big, bushy flowers with no flowers on them, probably too much nitrogen. If you get big, bushy peppers with no peppers on them, too much nitrogen. So if she's saying her tomatoes grew well, she got a lot of tomatoes, which a lot of people did this year. It's a good year for tomatoes. Then I think she's doing everything correct.
Result for Chandra.
There you go.
Let's take another call, Charlie. Brian is calling from North Ferrisburg. Brian, go right ahead with your question for Charlie Nardozzi.
Hi, good afternoon. I have two perennials that I've been having trouble with for years. And the first is garden phlox. It yellows early in the season. You know, it comes up strong. It yellows throughout the leaves. And it still does flower, but it looks peaked. And right next to it could be another phlox or it within the same garden. And it looks fine. Mostly the Davids look fine, but a lot of my pinks and reds are... They just have this yellowing, and it's throughout the whole plant, and I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's probably powdery mildew, which sounds like you're familiar with that disease on phlox. And some of the first signs of it is not the white powdery mildew on the leaves, but it's actually a yellowing of the leaves. And so that variety is probably very susceptible to it. And my suggestion would be, go shopping next spring. There are a lot of – you mentioned David or David. That's one of the powdery mildew-resistant varieties. There's a number of them out there now of different colors too, not just all whites but pinks and reds and purples. So I would do a little research in the winter. Go shopping, and I would replace that phlox that gets all the powdery mildew with one that's mildew-resistant.
I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. There's nothing wrong with winter. It's my favorite season. But as long as the ground hasn't started to freeze, there are still great opportunities to plunge shovel into earth and breathe in that beautiful aroma of rich soil. If that last statement almost made you weep openly, then you have got to be excited that Vermont Garden Journal host Charlie Nardozzi is our guest today. All right, let's get a few more, Charlie. Brett in West Berlin writes, is the fall the better time to transplant rhubarb, or should I wait until spring?
I would say wait until spring for rhubarb. And the thing to do with rhubarb is that it's really early in the spring, like April probably, when it first starts popping out of the ground. You start seeing those little red balls almost coming out of the ground, which is the leaf that's all been curled up. That's when I would dig it up, divide it, put it in another location, well-drained soil, mix in a bunch of compost or composted manure. It likes a nice rich soil. And then you'll be all set. It'll recover and you'll be able to actually eat it, especially if you have big divisions. You'll probably be able to eat it that year as well.
That's fantastic. Jillian from Tunbridge emailed, how can I best remove an overgrown beech rind? I could also use some advice on planting peony roots.
What was the beech rind?
Beech rind.
Beach ride. That sounds like something you do on the coast. Rick, let's go for a beach ride.
I was hoping you knew what it was.
I don't know what a beach ride is. Beach tree, of course.
Yeah.
But I'm not quite sure about that.
All right. Well, let's go to her peony part. Roots question. Need some advice on planting peony roots.
Okay. So I'm assuming that she's got them from a garden center or somewhere and she wants to plant them now. The key with planting peonies is to make sure you don't plant the crown of the plant too deep. So the crown is where I would like to call it the roots and the shoots meet. It's kind of right at that spot. And you can see it a lot of times. It's kind of like a little bulbous area. If you plant that deeper than 2 inches in the soil, there's a chance that your peony will not flower for you. So make sure you plant that just barely underneath the soil surface. Put a little mulch around it to keep it well watered right into November or so. And of course, plant it in a sunny spot. Peonies are very long-lived perennials. So put it somewhere that if you can imagine that tree over there, what it's going to look like in 20 years.
If
it starts to put some shade over here, it means you'll have to move it again.
Yeah.
So put it somewhere where it's not going to have a chance 10, 20 years down the road to be shaded out.
All right, let's talk about some trees. We got Ted in Nelson, New Hampshire calling in. Ted, what's your question for Charlie today?
My question, well, not really a question. It's more of a comment, really. A couple of weeks ago, Charlie, you were talking about planting shrubs and trees in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to take a really strong issue with that. Plant science dictates that roots really need warm temperatures to grow. And it might have been all right 2 weeks ago to do that for that day, but it's just the fall is the wrong time to plant anything that has woody structure in the plant. That's my opinion anyway.
All right. Well, okay. Get Joey's response to that, Ted, because we do quite often plant trees and shrubs in the fall and have no problem with them when spring hits.
The key is, you know, as I was mentioning at the beginning of the show, we are getting a little late for some of these things. You want to have at least 4 to 6 weeks of a freeze-free ground so that the roots can get a little bit established. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, I really lean more towards deciduous plants because they're not transpiring through the winter. If you put a pine tree or a spruce tree out this time of year and it's a big tree and the roots are not really getting established, if we have a really rough winter, you could lose that tree pretty easily. And you see it happen a lot of times when they're doing road construction. A lot of the evergreens that they put out may not make it through the winter. So stick with this deciduous trees. Make sure if you're going to put them in so you at least have a month or so before the ground's going to freeze. Keep them well watered. And most of the science I've seen, and even up this far north, it says you can plant in the fall and be effective. And so if you try it and it works, that's great. There's always a chance planting spring or fall that something's going to die.
Right.
That's just kind of the nature of planting. And sometimes it's due to the weather. Sometimes it's due to the plants. Sometimes
it's stress on the plant from
unknown factors. Yeah. Exactly.
All right. So do you need to be concerned about having mulch around the trunks and stems of these trees and shrubs?
I usually recommend it, everything from a perennial, we're talking about planting peonies, up to some trees or shrubs, to put some bark mulch around it. But don't put it right up against the stem because that creates a situation that we call volcano mulching. And you probably have seen that if you've driven around
fun,
in the spring.
But it's not
it
good,
sounds fun, yeah. Unless you're in Hawaii, I guess. So you've seen it if you drive around in the spring where some landscapers will throw mulch and you have this kind of cone going up the trunk of the tree. That creates a situation inside near the crown of the tree where it's going to rot. It keeps too much moisture right next to the tree stem or trunk. So if you're going to use bark mulch, make sure you do it the opposite. Make a donut. So or a moat is probably a better way to look at it. Keep the mulch on the outer edge. Don't have it right up against the stem. Keep it at least 6 inches or so away from that stem. What the mulch will do is not so much it's going to insulate the roots from the cold because it gets cold here. The ground freezes. It gets cold. But what it does is it insulates it from freezing and thawing because that's what will happen in our winters more and more so with our winters changing where we'll get a real warm spell in January, February and things thaw out and then the temperatures plummet again. That freezing and thawing causes a situation called frost heave, which will literally heave a plant out of the ground, especially perennials that haven't been really well established yet. Mm. So the mulch helps protect against that happening.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. We got another call from Morris in Ira. Morris, thanks for calling today. What's your question?
I planted a Yuri pear tree about 10 years ago. It's about 25 feet high, and it's produced wonderful fruit. But last year, it flowered out beautifully, and about a week later, dropped all its petals and then started to lose its leaves. It did the same thing this year, I'm trying to figure out what's going on with it.
So did it recover after having that happen in the spring? Did it leaf back out again?
No.
Oh, it's so
no,
right?
It looks like it by July, it looked like it was ready for winter. It has new buds on it again.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like it's had some kind of stress. So it may be a root disease, a root rot disease of some type that's gotten in there. It's hard to tell without doing tissue samples and actually looking at the tree to know exactly what it is. But it does sound like it might have something to do with the root system and the vascular system trying to bring nutrients and water up to the tree. Some things you can do is put some compost around the tree. I don't know if it's growing in a clay soil versus a silt or a sandy soil. But if it's a clay soil, trying to loosen up that soil a little bit. I like planting things like comfrey around fruit trees and clay soil especially because comfrey has a taproot that'll go down and mine the minerals and open up the soil so you get a better airflow and less likelihood of those moisture-loving fungi and other kind of diseases from getting started.
Morris, do you know what the soil is around it at all?
Yeah, it's good soil. It's basically riverbanks soil like meadow soil.
Okay.
The tree, up until 2 years ago, has been just a glorious thing to look at. It always was in wonderful condition. Now, oddly enough, I have a friend 40 miles away. His tree is doing exactly the same thing as mine.
Huh, that's interesting. Same variety, too.
Same variety, Uri pear, and he has no idea what caused it either. There are no other pear trees around.
Yeah, yeah. Huh. It may sound like it's more of a kind of a weather condition thing, too. Maybe too much water, too little water, that kind of thing that has affected that root system. And it's a regional thing, so your friend 40 miles away is also getting that same effect.
We got this from Marilyn in Brattleboro. We are a volunteer group that has two public help-yourself gardens and are planning to add fruit trees to the mix. We are planting Asian pear trees and peach trees. When is the best time to plant bare root trees, and what varieties would you recommend? What do we need to do to prepare the soil, and are there any special care needs in their early years?
Yes.
Oh, excellent.
To everything.
Oh, wow.
So you want to plant in the spring. You may go to a garden center and see some peach trees that have been there all summer that aren't great sale or discount or something. But I think if you really want to have success, and especially a public garden like this, I would wait till the spring. You can order things through garden centers. They can order them for you. You can order them through the mail, bare rooted. And bare root is actually a great way to go with a lot of these fruit trees, especially the Asian pears and peaches, because you'll get a tree that you can look at the root system. And this is kind of the newest thing with planting trees and shrubs, whether they be fruit or ornamental trees and shrubs, is that you want to make sure the root system does not have roots that are swirling around. Because what they've found is that if you plant that tree or shrub with roots that are swirling around, over time, that will strangle the tree. So you put a peach tree in, for example, grows well, starts fruiting. 5 years down the road, it just dies all of a sudden. You don't know why. You dig it up and you'll see that there's a main root that's kind of wrapped around the trunk of the tree.
Oh.
So having a bare root tree, you don't have to worry about that because you can see the roots. You can see where they're going. You can prune them if you need to. And so ordering those in advance sometime this winter is a nice thing to do. For peaches, the go-to variety for Vermont is Reliance, and that's a peach that is very winter hardy. But since you're in Brattleboro and you're in the banana belt.
Way down south.
You're way down south there. Right. You're almost in Massachusetts.
That's right.
You can do other varieties like Contender, for example, or Red Haven. There's a number of different varieties you can probably try. I would check with local nurseries down in that area and see what they're carrying and see what kind of success they've had with different peach varieties. For the Asian pears, there's a number of different varieties out there. I grow one called 20th Century. And Shinseki is another one, and Chojuro is another one. There's a number of different varieties. You want to have two different varieties for those. The peaches, you don't have to have two different varieties. The Reliance especially will produce by itself. But with the Asian pears, you need to have two different varieties so you make sure that you get good cross-pollination.
Oh, wow.
It's a matter of the pollen being adapted to each one of the trees. So those are some varieties to try. And in the spring, as soon as you can get out there, work the soil, dig a hole pretty big, 3 times the diameter of what would be the root ball. So a nice big hole, not so deep, but wide. And you don't want to amend the soil unless it's really bad soil. If you have really gravelly soil, if it's an urban soil, you might even want to watch out for things, other materials that have gotten buried over the years, asphalt and petroleum products and things like that. So when you're digging, you kind of have to make that assessment. And if it looks like it's pretty good soil and it seems okay, then don't worry about amending it.
Now, Charlie, when this – oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if it's poor soil, then you want to put a little compost in.
All right. When the season's done, I'm the guy who just throws those garden tools like right back in the shed. Is there a good maintenance regime to follow at the end of a gardening season?
Well, ideally, and I'm guilty of that too.
All right.
Ideally, what you would want to do with your tools is you want to clean them up. So get any rust or anything that's off your hose or your shovels. You can do that with a brush, a wire brush, to kind of clean them up a little bit. You can even sharpen them that time of year. So why wait till the spring to sharpen them when the people who do the sharpening or yourself tend to be more busy? So go out and sharpen the edges of your hose, the edges of your edger, the edges of the spades that you're using so they're nice and sharp and you get a nice clean cut. If you have wooden handles, it's nice to treat those. Wash them first and then treat them with some linseed oil. That will help preserve the wood a little bit, be less likely to dry out, less likely to crack. And then put them in a place where they're not going to get wet. Don't just leave them outside in a leaky shed or something like that. Hang them up somewhere where they'll stay dry all winter, and then they will reward you by being ready to plant when you are.
All right, let's go all the way to the Canadian border and talk to Peggy from East Charleston. Peggy, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi, thanks for having me. So it's perfect timing. I'm outside today in the warm, what we've got left of it, and I've got these hydrangeas, and so they're not like those kind of more like tree-like hydrangeas. They're the ones that are more low-growing and have like a deep pink ball flower. So the thing is that I only have one flower this year on all, each of my two bushes. I just got the one flower. I wonder what I did wrong when I planted them last year, or should I not have cut them back in the fall? Or, I'm just trying to figure out why my hydrangeas aren't blooming this year.
Yeah, I'm assuming you have what we call the ever-blooming hydrangeas. Like there's some that are blue, but there now are some that are pink and red too, like the Endless Summer, for example. And those hydrangeas are unique in the sense that usually that variety, that type of hydrangea, doesn't make it through the winter very well, and it flowers on its old wood. So it needs wood to make it through the winter, needs those stems to survive the cold in order for it to flower the next year. Those traditional varieties in that realm would never survive in Vermont because they'd always die back to the ground. Then came about 20 or 30 years ago, these new Endless Summer kind of hydrangeas that will flower not only on the old wood that survives the winter, but on the new wood that comes out of the ground. Mm. So what probably happened, it sounds like you cut it back in the fall, which is not what you want to do. You want to leave it there. You want to see if you can get some of those old stems to survive the winter. So you can cut it back to maybe a foot or two tall, but then come Thanksgiving or so, throw a bunch of mulch around it, bark mulch on it to protect those stems. If you can get them to survive the winter, they're going to flower sooner in the year than the ones that the stems that come out of the ground. So what you're seeing now are the ones that grew out of the ground, grew all summer, finally got to the flowering stage, and it's October. Time for a frost.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about cutting back. I mean, what kind of cutting back is good to do right now?
Well, you could start with any of your herbaceous perennials, you know, any of the ones that you cut back to the ground. For example, we just cut back some peonies that some of them look beautiful with nice fall foliage. Others were loaded with powdery mildew. So it was like there's no need to keep them out there. So cutting those back to the ground, the bee bombs, the phlox that may be done, any of those perennials that aren't really blooming anymore or didn't come back and bloom a second or third time, you can cut those back to the ground. That's a good thing to do. Start cleaning up the vegetable garden. Our cucumbers are done, for example. We're going to rip those out and plant some garlic in there. Beans that are done. You know, don't be so soft-hearted about these things. You know, I know people will see their bean plants like, oh my God, there's a flower still on my bean plant. Pull it out.
Oh, Charlie, you're heartless.
Got to be tough. It's a lot of tough love out there with vegetables especially. Because you do want to clean up a lot of these things before it gets really cold and really nasty, and then you're going to have no motivation to go out if it's 40 degrees and freezing rain. And then you'll leave it out there, and by leaving it out there, you're leaving potentially insects and diseases that'll overwinter and infest your new crops next year.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singarian for Jane Lindholm. Gardening expert and Vermont Garden Journal host Charlie Nardozzi is our guest today. Charlie, do you take notes or keep notes on what worked or didn't work in your yard or gardens during the year?
Well, somewhat. What Wendy and I, my wife Wendy and I, have been doing, which is I find much more helpful, is to take pictures throughout the season.
Oh, okay.
So in spring and summer and late summer and fall, first of all, it tells you what's growing well, and your memory sometimes lapses. It's like, oh, yeah, that coreopsis, I thought it was doing so well. And you look at it in July, and it's like, meh, doesn't even have flowers on it. So it kind of tells you what did well, what didn't do well through the season. But it also, more importantly, this time of year, will let you know where you planted things like bulbs. So where are all the daffodils? Where's the hyacinths? Where are the crocuses? Because everyone's going to go out now this month to plant their spring flowering bulbs, and we never could remember where we planted them, right?
Oh, that's a brilliant
idea. If you have pictures
of
when they were blooming, then you can see exactly where they were.
All right. Well, that's a great answer, Charlie. Okay, we heard from Maggie. She wants to know, how do I properly store seeds from plants like squash and tomatoes for next year?
Well, squash is problematic because squash has male and female flowers. And so depending upon the squash you're trying to save and what you're growing, if you have a couple different varieties of squash, for example, they're going to cross-pollinate. And so it won't affect the crop this year. So that zucchini that you have there will be a zucchini. But if you have your zucchini and your straight-neck squash or some other ones, yellow squash that are there, and they cross-pollinate, you save the seeds. When you plant those next year, you're going to get a whole hodgepodge of kinds of squash.
Oh, my.
And probably not what you like. So squash would be a hard one for a beginning gardener to actually try to save the seeds, because you need to isolate plants and make sure they don't get cross-pollinated and actually hand-pollinate them.
Yeah.
Tomatoes are a little less that problem. The key thing with tomatoes is make sure that it's an open-pollinated or heirloom variety. Don't try to save the seeds from a hybrid because you run into that same problem. It's got a lot of genetic background to it. So when you save the seeds, you get all kinds of the parent lines kind of pop up and you don't get the same kind of tomato. But with heirlooms and open-pollinated, they tend to be self-fertile, meaning that they're self-pollinating. You'll see bees visiting them and stuff, but they tend not to cross too much. And it's pretty easy to save the seed. You would wait till your tomato gets nice and mushy ripe. Take those seeds out there. Put them in some water and let the seeds and the pulp and everything kind of form a mold almost on the top. Mm. And that's going to actually break down a chemical that's in the seeds that inhibits it from germinating. And then wash all that out, dry them out, put them in a little baby food jar or something like that, or even some plastic in a cool, dark place. And then you'll have them for next year.
It is coming up on Halloween. Any advice on picking pumpkins, carving pumpkins?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's pumpkin time.
It is pumpkin time.
And it's great because there's all different kinds of pumpkins out there. You know, they used to be just your orange jack-o'-lantern kind of field pumpkin.
Yep.
But now there's little ones, there's big ones, there's white ones, there's red ones, there's orange ones. There are some that have warts on them that look really kind of cool and spooky in and of themselves. So shop around and kind of look. You know, you can decorate a winter squash too, or gourds. You know, it doesn't have to be just a pumpkin. Whatever you're using, though, there's a few keys, especially if you're going to carve it for the holidays. So carve it close to Halloween. You know, don't try to carve it now, and we'll have 2 weeks or so before that happens.
It starts to cave in.
And then if the weather is warm, especially as you're getting close to Halloween, say the weekend before, and you and the kids are carving them, after you've done carving them, soak the whole pumpkin in a barrel of water. Just put it in a barrel of water overnight, and that'll help hydrate it, help keep it nice and moist. Pull it out of the water, then get some petroleum jelly, and just kind of seal it almost like you would with a lip gloss all around the cuts. So that, again, will seal the moisture in. It'll be less likely to just kind of cave in on itself by Halloween and look fresh.
Oh, I love that, Charlie. All right, we're going to take another call. Deborah's calling us from Moortown. Deborah, what's your question today?
Hello there. I used for my window boxes some of my kitchen and garden compost this year. So I mixed it in with the commercial potting soil for the window boxes. And lo and behold, I ended up with some odd, like, cherry tomato growing in the flower boxes.
Look at that.
So what did I do wrong?
Oh, so what happened?
All right.
I don't know. So what happened is you probably had some cherry tomatoes that were in the compost, and your compost pile didn't heat up enough to actually kill all the seeds and all the other things that are in there. And so those seeds survived. And when you took some of that compost, it may have had a few seeds. Even if you cleaned the compost well, a few seeds might have snuck through. You used it in there, and then they would germinate and grow. So, yes, it's always a mystery when those things come out of the compost pile, but that's probably what happened.
All right, and this leads perfectly into this question that Jim in North Hero sent us. I usually burn rather than compost my tomato vines to reduce the risk of blight. My cucumber beetle problem gets worse year after year with my squash, cukes, and melons. Is there anything that winters in the vines that I should burn them also, or can I continue to compost them? Is there anything else that I should burn rather than compost?
So burning of the squash vines or even the tomato vines, I don't think is really going to make that much of a difference because a lot of these diseases or insects are more ubiquitous. They're just kind of in the environment. They're in the soil. They're in the weeds that are around. So if you have a lot of disease, certainly if you had late blight, for example, on tomatoes, you'd want to destroy those. But for the cucurbits that he's mentioning, the cucumber beetle issues that he has on his melons and squash and cucumbers, I think what you can do is make sure you're rotating, make sure you're planting your cucumbers in different places. What I've done to actually help with our cucumbers is I've grown them in straw bales. And that's a whole technique called straw bale gardening. And you can look that up if you go to strawbalegardening.com, for example. It'll give you the whole technique. But the idea is that you put a bale on its side, so it's up off the ground. You put some fertilizer in it so that the bale starts decomposing, and you plant literally right in the bale. And because it's elevated up a little bit, because it doesn't have a lot of soil in it at all, for that matter, the cucumber beetles I've noticed didn't really bother it so much. So that might be a technique that you'd use. And then look for varieties that are a little more resistant to the cucumber beetle and try to get on top of it early in the season. Sprinkling something like diatomaceous earth is a nice powder that cucumber beetles don't like. Some people even use kaolin clay for that same reason. But making sure you start with a transplant that's a healthy plant, put a little of this powder on it to try to keep those cucumber beetles from getting established.
All right. Let's talk to Bill. He's calling us from Essex Junction. Bill, go right ahead. What's your question for Charlie?
Yes, hi. I am concisely plagued by Japanese knotweed, and I'm wondering if you can offer me any solution for arresting it so it doesn't spread anymore or making it go away forever.
Wow, that's a good question. If I had the answer to that question, Bill, I'd be a millionaire. Yeah, Japanese knotweed is just a really tough weed to get rid of. It's got roots that spread all over the place. You see it along riverbanks a lot because it gets spread down rivers and all around rivers. It likes that silty soil. The best thing with any of those really pernicious perennial weeds, like the Japanese knotweed, like the gout weeds, like the horsetail, all of those, I always tell people, draw a line in the sand. Kind of decide, this is as far as I want it to encroach. Mm. And at that point, dig down, try to rip out anything that's on your side of that area so you can kind of keep it from going over there, and putting in a big divider of some type, some kind of edging in there. It could be metal. It could be heavy-duty wood. It could be heavy-duty plastic, something that's going to keep it from encroaching over it. And then be diligent about going back and keeping the air, the clean area clean so it doesn't kind of sneak in. That's probably about the best thing you can do. I mean, if you want to get rid of the whole patch, if you keep cutting it down repeatedly summer after summer, you eventually will exhaust it. That will work for it. But the herbicides that are out there, things of that nature, really are not going to help you in the long run. It's just more your diligence and your feeling like I'm going to beat this thing is going to be the thing that works.
Let's talk about another pest. Amanda in Charlotte emailed, we have an overabundance of poison ivy on our property. Is there anything you could suggest to combat it?
Yeah, so poison ivy, kind of like the Japanese knotweed, another one that spreads all over the place. Now, poison ivy, you can get a little, use some herbicides on it if you want to do that. And the way to do it to be the safest for the environment but be effective on the poison ivy is find where that big stem is coming out of the soil. And usually there'll be a couple of them, like grapevine stems. Cut it about a foot tall, and then you can paint it with some of these brush killers, some of the herbicides that are out there that are systemic, that'll go down into the root system, but then cover it over. I usually tell people, put a little like yogurt container or something over it, duct tape it, so that no animals or nobody's going to get harmed by that pesticide being there. And that way you've kind of reduced the exposure to the environment with that pesticide, but you have tried to kill that poison ivy.
Boy, I said that Amanda was in Charlotte. She's in Charlotte, of
course. I was wondering, like, oh my goodness, where are you living,
Rick? I don't know.
Oh, Charlotte.
Hey, but talking about going far in places, you've got a couple trips coming up next year.
Yes. We're going to Cuba. The end of March, we're going down to Cuba for about 8 days. Unfortunately for the listeners, the trip is filled, but we are taking waiting list names if you are interested in that trip. It's going to be about gardening and the culture and history of Cuba. And then next fall, around this time, maybe a little earlier, next September, we'll be going to the Italian Lake District, seeing the gardens of Lake Como, Lake Maggiore, Lake Garda, that whole area, going into Venice. So if you're interested in that trip, go to my website, gardeningwithcharlie.com. Keep your eyes peeled. Sign up for the newsletter and you'll find out all about it.
And we do have a link to gardeningwithcharlie.com on today's show page at vpr.net. Charlie Nardozzi is a gardening expert. He's the host of the Vermont Garden Journal on VPR. Charlie, it's always great having you to get our gardens right. So thanks for coming by again.
Happy fall.